The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So tonight, I'm continuing exploring with you the some of the Buddhist teachings, some of the texts in the teachings that I've particularly found inspiring. And tonight there's one that I'd like to explore with you. It's called The Simile of the Cloth, and it's found in the Majjhima Nikaya. For those of you who are interested in this, it's number 7 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And so to me, this teaching, it describes kind of the entire path of practice. It takes us from the beginning when we first meet the teachings and first are starting to look at our minds, when they're kind of a mess, and kind of what we see when we look at our minds is a lot of reactivity, to what it means to explore that and what happens in the course of our practice. And so it begins with this simile that kind of frames the way the teaching of this particular sutta unfolds. So I'll read the simile to you. Suppose a cloth were stained, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or carmine. It would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth, because of the stains on the cloth. So too, when the mind is stained, an unhappy destination may be expected. Suppose a cloth were bright and pure, and a dyer dipped that in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or carmine. It would look well dyed and pure in color. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is not stained, a happy destination can be expected. And so the framing here is around this analogy of the stained cloth and a cloth that is not stained. And we can understand, too, that our minds begin by being stained. We have so much in the way of reactivity. And that's what is meant by stained here. This word stained is translating the Pali word kalesa, which basically means something like a stained cloth. And so it's using this analogy for our minds. The staining in terms of this understanding of what stains the mind is those things that get in the way of a deep kind of happiness. Those things that get in the way of love, of kindness, of compassion, of balance of mind. This is the direction, and this is the pointing of what the Buddha taught. It's not kind of the encouragement is towards cultivating those states which help us to move away from struggle, from stress, from suffering, from reactivity, and towards non-reactivity, towards ease of mind, towards peace. And this is the whole framing of what is skillful and what is unskillful. What would be non-staining and what would be staining. Those things that move us towards reactivity stain the mind, or those are stains in the mind. Those things that move us away from reactivity are the things that support us in purifying the mind, in clearing the mind, the kind of like the soap that cleans a cloth, in a way. So, starting with this analogy, the Buddha goes on to list a whole bunch of stains. He says, and so what are the things that stain the mind? He lists 16 of them. I think there are probably more, but here's a selection. Covetousness and greed, ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, negligent, These things stain the mind. And in terms of, again, in terms of stain, it means these things keep the mind from having peace, having ease. And in some ways, you know, paradoxically, the way our minds have been trained, the way our cultures train us, actually, is to believe that some of these things, like ill will, for instance, is something that might take us to happiness. You know, in some odd way, and I definitely saw this as I explored anger in my own experience, I saw that there was some belief in the mind that being angry, well, as I began to look at the belief, I began to see that I thought that being angry would mean the other person would be miserable and somehow that would make me happy. So that like, somehow our minds kind of twist around these reactive patterns to somehow, it's somewhere deep inside we think they're helping us. We think they're taking us in a helpful direction. But as soon as we start to actually look at them, as soon as we start to actually explore and be aware of what the experience of any of these is, ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, obstinacy, conceit even, these experiences, when we start to look at them with mindfulness, which is the practice the Buddha offers us in exploring our minds, when we look at them with mindfulness, we see they don't feel so good. You know, that in the moment when we're experiencing these states of mind, we are suffering. So this helps to point out to us their staining nature, let's say, that they are not helpful to us. So the next piece of the sutta points to it's helpful to recognize these stains of the mind and get to know something about them, to understand that they are stains, essentially is what he says. Knowing that ill will, anger, resentment, contempt are stains of the mind, he says, knowing that they are stains of the mind, one abandons them. So this I think, bears some exploration, what this means, that as we understand that something is a stain of the mind, or something is something that creates reactivity in our minds, we could say, something that gets in the way of ease or peace in our hearts. As we understand that, the Buddha says the mind that the mind abandons those things. And I want to explore that for a bit, because I think we may misunderstand what abandon means here. We might think it means willfully set aside. I guess that's one way that the word abandon is used in our language. It can be used, you know, we abandon a child or something. You know, it's not, sometimes the word isn't used in a way that sounds very constructive. And yet there are other uses of the term that maybe begin to point to some of what I think is meant here in this teaching. So the sentence is understanding or knowing that these reactions, these reactivities of mind are stains in the mind, or understanding that these states are suffering in the mind. They are abandoned. And if we begin to explore with mindfulness these experiences, as I said a few minutes ago, we begin to see that they hurt, that greed actually is painful, that anger and ill will and contempt are painful. And so we begin to understand that they are not in the moment leading to our well-being. The word abandon at times has this kind of connotation of understanding. When we understand that something is no longer useful, we let it go. And so, for instance, a car, you know, if we, you know, if we find, if a car just, you know, has run to its last, you know, it just cannot run anymore, then we let it go. We know that it's just not working. This mode of transport, this has not taken me anywhere. It's more effort than it's worth to keep this car going. And so we abandon it, partly because we understand that it's not a functioning car anymore, that it's not useful. Another use of the term abandon is kind of the phrase abandon ship. When we abandon something, when we see it's dangerous to remain. And so we let go, we leave something when we recognize the danger of staying. If you stay on that ship that's sinking, you will drown. Abandoning ship, there's some hope for not drowning. So this I think is pointing to some of the meaning of the term abandon here. First of all, we have to understand, through the practice of mindfulness, we begin to understand both the non-useful nature of our reactive states of mind and their dangerous nature. They're not useful. And again, it's useful in terms of what we are exploring or the direction we may hope to head. So, you know, there might be some people in this world that think anger is very useful. And there are things which anger does incline us to accomplish. And yet the suffering, both inside and outside, that is related to anger. And we might think, for instance, that with some of these reactive emotions, that they're kind of our motivations. If I didn't have greed, if I didn't have anger, why would I do anything? If I didn't want to get rid of things and want to hold on to things, why would I do anything? We might think that. And yet the movement towards doing something can be motivated by other qualities than anger and greed. So for instance, compassion can be a motivator. When we see suffering happening in the world, anger might be a response, and we might be motivated, if we see an injustice in the world, for instance, anger might be a response to that, and we might be motivated to do something about that injustice through that anger. But compassion can also be a motivation. Compassion can be a response to injustice. And that compassion doesn't have the same kind of burn or damaging nature to our own system. And it also, and when we're burning and we're putting that energy out into the world, it tends to burn others too. And so compassion is a different kind of motivating energy that we might be able to move towards. And indeed, in the sutta, it points in that direction. This is what follows, actually. It follows on as these beautiful motivations begin to become the natural ground of our being as these reactivities begin to weaken. As we begin to understand they're not so helpful, we begin to let them go. Now, to me, this teaching about abandoning has some depth to it. It's it's a single sentence here, but you know, sometimes I give a whole talk on this very topic of just understanding and abandoning. What does it mean to understand our experience? You know, as we begin to actually look at our experience, we understand it's an experience happening now. All of these states of mind are experiences that impact us in the here and now. And as we feel the human nature of those experiences, of all of those reactive experiences, we begin to feel, and our system begins to understand, the unhelpful and dangerous nature. Dangerous in terms that it keeps us stuck to struggle and suffering. As we engage in these kind of reactive emotions, it tends to deepen their grooves, makes us more inclined to react out of those kinds of reactive emotions. And so we're kind of digging our grooves deeper if we're continuing to act out of those reactive emotions. But as soon as we see and recognize, oh, this hurts, and explore with mindfulness, what is the human experience of any of these reactive states? That's a completely different relationship to that experience. It's a completely different relationship to contempt, ill will, greed, anger, to know this is the human experience. This is how it feels for a human being to be experiencing greed. This is how it feels for a human being to be experiencing ill will. When I first understood or heard this teaching, I didn't get it. I didn't see how it could possibly work, that turning towards and being attentive to, essentially being mindful of reactivity, would in any way weaken it. It seemed to me that it would simply strengthen it. But I was willing to give it a try, partly because I kind of hit bottom with my reactivity and was so caught by it that I found myself non-functional at times. And I got a book, somebody sent me a book, and it said, try being mindful of your reactivity instead of following through on it. And I couldn't see how it would work, but I was willing to try it. And so I did. I tried it. And within a very short time, it became clear to me how helpful it was. So initially, I did not have the confidence in that teaching. But I was willing to try. And in a way, that's a beginning of a form of faith. You know, it's like I was willing, because a friend of mine had sent me this book and said, hey, I found this helpful when I was, you know, in situations like yours. I found this information helpful, so why don't you try it? And so I was willing, hearing from my friend, I was willing to try that. And so that was a kind of a step on the path. And very quickly, it became clear to me kind of how it worked, which was that as soon as I became aware of the experience of anger, the first thing it felt was how painful it was. And then I realized, the next thing that I realized was that I had a choice in this moment to either stay caught in the loop. You know, at that moment, there was enough awareness to realize the mind was in this loop of thoughts that reinforced that reactivity. And I had a choice to turn my attention to something else, to my work, for instance. It's like, well, I don't know what to do with this uncomfortable feeling, but I can go back to work. And in that process, over the next few weeks, I discovered that the reactivity was weakening, and the mindfulness was recognizing that reactivity earlier and earlier in the process. And so I was no longer so non-functional. Very quickly, within the space of a few weeks, the level of dysfunction had really eased, and I could function again. And so it became clear to me that this was useful. So it was useful in terms of helping me to let go of the suffering of that reactivity. And so the mind, actually, as I look at this, the mind began to weaken the reactivity and abandon it. It was in the process of abandoning it, even as I explored it. Even as I opened to it with mindfulness, that very process of being curious about it was the tool that let it start to become abandoned. I didn't have to do the abandoning so much. I didn't have to try to abandon it. It was the natural result of that curiosity of what is this human experience? And so to me, that is what abandoning is. It's not something we do necessarily, although there are times, so for instance, that moment in my experience where I recognize, wow, yep, this is anger, wow, this hurts, what do I do with this? In a way, I could see that I could go back to work rather than like staying stuck in the loop. And so that was something I chose to do. That was a kind of a conscious shift of attention. That's a kind of abandoning. It's a redirecting of the attention. I didn't try to repress that feeling. I didn't try to get rid of it. I just redirected the attention. That can be a very helpful tool for us as we find ourselves stuck with reactivity that feels very like we're just glommed onto it. Maybe sometimes we can choose to redirect the attention to something neutral, not try to repress it or get rid of that reactivity, but simply say, yep, you know, you can hang out there, but I'm going to put my attention someplace else. I'm going to redirect the attention. But much of the time and much of my appreciation for the practice has come through recognizing that the abandoning happens the more we understand our experience through this practice of mindfulness. Understanding here doesn't mean an intellectual understanding. We can have an intellectual understanding, and I certainly had an intellectual understanding that the anger was painful, but I couldn't stop it. So, you know, that it's not about an intellectual understanding here. It's the transformative power of understanding comes through the willingness to be mindful of experience directly in the moment as human experience. And then the abandoning will follow. Abandoning is the result of our practice. In the teaching, this is a big part of our work. We start with our reactive minds and we begin to explore. We begin to be curious about the reactivity, not rejecting it, but also not buying into it. This is, I think, the middle path the Buddha talked about. You know, we neither buy into nor push away. We explore, what does it mean to be right in the middle, just opening to it with mindfulness? And as the understanding grows, we get little tastes of that abandoning. You know, as I experienced in those first weeks, and as I experience over and over again in my practice, as the mind sees something that it's stuck to and really sees it and understands it and lets it go, that abandoning, we get little tastes of that abandoning. It feels like being released from some kind of a vice grip or some kind of a knot. We get little tastes of that release. And with the tastes of that release, we gain confidence. We gain confidence in the teaching. We gain confidence in ourselves. And so this is the next section of the path. That once we have some sense of this understanding, we gain confidence. And with that confidence, we're actually more willing to continue the practice, to continue exploring. It's said that with that confidence, we gain gladness. And I, you know, we can see this happen, that in the moment of seeing how the practice functions, how the practice works, see that release. There's a delight that can happen there. Even in the midst of exploring something really painful, there can be a delight in the seeing of it. Oh, the seeing of a pattern of frustration or impatience, and the seeing of it, giving us some space around it, there can be some delight in that. There can be joy that follows. And the mind can begin to settle down because it's no longer so reactive to its reactivity. And the reactivity begins to calm down also. And so this is talked about as a very natural unfolding. It says, one, with that confidence, one gains inspiration in the teachings, gains gladness and joy. One who's joyful becomes calm. One who's calm feels pleasure, and one who feels pleasure becomes concentrated. And so this is just understood to be, again, a kind of a natural unfolding. As the mind releases reactivity, as that abandoning happens, very naturally the mind begins to pick up wholesome, beautiful qualities. And here it lists them: inspiration, joy, calm, pleasure, and concentration. And so this is coming back to the analogy of the cloth, the work of understanding the stains, the work of understanding the reactivity leads to the release of the reactivity. It's kind of like, you know, the mindfulness practice is kind of like we've taken that stained cloth and thrown it into a washing machine. The mindfulness is the soap. The water is, maybe we could say, is our minds, our consciousness. And the agitator is the effort that we make to continue to stay present. And so we throw the soap and the cloth and the water in the washing machine and start, you know, turning away. And this is like our practice. The in the washing machine, the soap kind of gets pushed through the cloth, and the way the soap works, it kind of latches onto the stains, the stuff in the stains, and it, as the water keeps being pushed through the cloth, it draws the stains, what's making the stain, out into the water. And then the water can be washed away. The water can be rinsed. And so this kind of analogy actually works pretty well for mindfulness. If the mindfulness is the soap, that's like it's sticking to all of that reactivity. You know, when we explore with mindfulness our reactivity, that's like the soap touching the reactivity. And with the effort to stay with it, then that reactivity gets pulled into consciousness. We become aware. Oh yeah, this hurts. This is the experience of reactivity. Whereas before, when we were not so mindful, as I expressed with my thinking about anger gonna hurt the other person, you know, I was not so conscious that the anger was causing me pain. But as soon as I turned to look at it, the very first time I looked at it, it was very clear. Yes, this hurts. That is part of how mindfulness works. It draws the reactivity into consciousness so that we can know it, feel it, and then it can be released. Like the water being release, the water being washed away and fresh water filling in the tub. So that when the cloth is cleaned, it naturally, the analogy says, it will naturally take up any dye and look pure. It will look like it one even color. And so I think likewise with this, with the analogy here, it's like once we've released, once the reactivities are released, very naturally the mind begins to take up what we could call the wholesome dyes of inspiration and gladness and joy and tranquility and concentration. The mind begins to very naturally, with some ease, these qualities begin to be able to be cultivated in the mind. The next part is it moves to kind of an interesting statement. It says, once these defilements, that's the word often translated as kilesa, stains, defilements, once these stains are released and the mind has kind of moved towards concentration, it says, and one abides, pervading the world, infusing the world with a mind of loving kindness. And one abides, pervading the world with compassion and joy and equanimity. So these three are also some beautiful qualities. And again, it just says, one abides, pervading the world with metta, with love. It doesn't actually say one has to work really hard to do this. It makes it sound again like a very natural movement, a natural unfolding based on this kind of direction, all set in motion from this understanding and abandoning. Now, I think we do have to kind of keep our attention in the direction of understanding and wisdom and kindness and love, because there's so many habits that keep pulling us in the direction, so many forces in the world that keep pulling us in the direction of reactivity, that I think we do have to keep reminding ourselves, even as we've had tastes of that release, tastes of that freedom. And actually, it says here in the description of the releasing from that, the abandoning from all of this reactivity, it says, one understands, where is it? Let's see. When one understands that these reactions, that this reactivity, these stains have been relinquished in part, one gains confidence. And so, in part, all of this reactivity is released. We get little tastes of it here and there, and yet those little tastes are enough to set us in the direction of this path, this unfolding path. And yet, we do have to keep reminding ourselves, well, let's keep like heading this way, because we will keep getting pulled in the direction of what so much in our culture is aiming us towards. Greed and acquisitiveness and reactivity and anger, stoking all of that. So again, you know, this setting this in motion, this direction of understanding and abandoning, these qualities of mind begin to very naturally, thinking of the dye analogy, to dye a cloth, it's quite simple. You have the vat of dye and you drop the cloth in there, right? It's like you don't have to work very hard for that cloth to take up the dye. You drop it in the vat and then you can take out the cloth and it's got dye in it. And I think that's what we're being asked to do here. It's like incline the mind in the direction of love, in the direction of compassion. The mind that has released those reactions will kind of naturally take up, like the cloth takes up the dye, will naturally begin to take up those qualities. See how much I can do and what I want to do here. I think I'll talk a little bit about this peace of the qualities of love and compassion and joy. These are these qualities, these four, love, compassion, joy, equanimity, are known as the divine abidings. And I understand these, you know, this really these four qualities, we could say, are the emotional map of a heart that's let go of reactivity. What we habitually think of as our motivations, you know, our motivations often we think of as being the reactive states, the greed, the aversion. That's why we do things. When the heart has released that reactivity, then very naturally the motivations of these four, of love, of compassion, of joy, and of equanimity, become kind of the heart, the kind of the responsiveness of the heart. Instead of reacting to unpleasant experience or suffering in the world with aversion and anger, we respond with compassion. Instead of reacting to somebody else's good fortune with jealousy or envy, we respond with sympathetic joy. We're delighted for them. And so these qualities, they're beautiful qualities that are very naturally, they very naturally begin to unfold or begin to or get cultivated as we practice. And I think that this does happen in the very ground of the simple exploration of, wow, can I know this experience, this human experience? Opening to, allowing experience. We could use that word, allowing reactivity to be there. Not pushing it away, not being averse to it, not trying to hold on to it, but allowing, oh, this is the experience of frustration. This is the experience of greed. This is the experience of ill will. That allowing attitude of mind is already kind of in the direction of love. Because it's like we're holding our own difficulties with a heart that's not rejecting and it's not resisting and not trying to hold on to. It's a heart of compassion and a heart of love that we are cultivating, even as we cultivate this simple practice of mindfulness. And so very naturally, that quality is also strengthened along with mindfulness. The quality of love is also strengthened along with mindfulness. Another way that the love and the compassion happen or get revealed, I think, as we are mindful, as we are aware of what's going on in this, in the, these reactive states. And I think that I'm beginning to gain some confidence in this understanding, enough nearly to say that anytime there's reactivity, that basically that reactivity is going to be formed out of kind of two threads, two kind of counterbalancing or counterpoised things in our understanding and in our mind. So when we have some kind of reactivity, there's probably somewhere in there we may be able to find a thread that goes back to some wish to be happy, to be safe, to be at ease. Now, this is a deeply motivating force in our human system, to this movement towards well-being, this movement towards happiness. And so we have reactivity, and somewhere in there there's been this confused, like twisted up relationship to that wish for well-being. You know, so for instance, fear. Fear is very often a reaction to the wish, a reaction around the wish to be safe, and a feeling that it's not possible to be safe. I can't be safe. So, you know, we our reactivity has a thread that ties back to some wish for well-being for ourselves or others. The other side of the thread is that our reactivity is also often bound up against some deep truths, bound up with some deep truths to the world, that pretty much whatever is happening can have a flavor. It's not reliable. It's not going to last. It's impermanent. It's not reliable as a place to be, to hold on to be happy for forever, because it's impermanent. And often, most often, it's out of control. It's not something that we can control. And so looking, when we have reactivity, there's this thread towards some wish to be happy, safe, healthy, and the other side, there is often a thread towards, I want to be happy and it's out of control. I want to be safe and I can't fix this. I want to be happy and it's going to go away. I can't have this forever. So kind of as we begin to see that our reactivity is composed in a way of kind of tangled threads of those two sides. We've got the threads of wanting to be happy and the threads of truth, and they're all knotted up. And that's where our reactivity is in the knots of that. That we are afraid because I want to be safe, and it's out of control. So sometimes as we start to see our reactivity with mindfulness, we might think that basically we have to, you know, at least I kind of thought that it was like wholly bad, you know, that reactivity, that anger at that friend that I, you know, it's like I just want to get rid of this. This is bad stuff in there. It's poisoning me. And I kind of thought I needed to like take the scalpel and get that tumor out, you know, cut it out, just, you know, get scoop it out, get rid of it. But unfortunately, or maybe fortunately in a way, you know, that tumor, that reaction is composed entirely of a tangle of wanting to be happy and some understanding of the truth. And those two sides are not going to let you get rid of them. We can't cut those out. Essentially, we have to untangle the tangle. The tangle is the issue, not the wanting to be safe and the out of control nature of things. That is something that's quite difficult to understand. Certainly I've had the sense or the feeling like it's like, well, I see it's out of control and I know that's truth. And so I shouldn't want to be happy. I shouldn't want to be safe. And so somehow denigrating that wish for love and well-being, because I was kind of orienting towards truth or orienting towards, well, I see, yes, it's unreliable, it's out of control, so I shouldn't want to be happy. Well, that wish for happiness is a very wholesome, beautiful human wish. And what our hearts need to do is to start to stretch to encompass both of those threads. And as we do that, it's like the mindfulness, another way to make this analogy, is like the mindfulness begins to loosen the knots and untangle that tangle. And so until we can hold both those deep wishes and those truths of experience together, without being all knotted up about them. And again, this happens, this untangling begins to happen through the practice. And this untangling, anytime there's any kind of suffering, there's a pointer in some way to some belief or there's a pointer to, there's a way in which we can begin to recognize some deep wish for our own well-being there, and also some understanding of, yeah, it's unreliable. Yeah, it's uncontrollable. Some way that we can begin to align with truth there. And so this is another way that I think the practice begins to take us back to love. Because bound up in the middle of all of our reactivity, as we weaken those knots and loosen those tangles, we find ourselves much more able to hold those wishes without a heart that gets confused or contracted. And so there they are, available to be taken up. And the other side of that is the wisdom, the understanding around impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. And this is the final piece of this teaching that indicates, it points us to even understanding that these beautiful qualities of love, of compassion, of joy and equanimity also shouldn't be clung to. We may have a tendency to cling to them, to have the idea like I need to hold on to these. But instead what we begin to see is that the more we let go, the more we endlessly let go, the more those states are endlessly simply there and they don't need to be clung to. This is a turning towards understanding and wisdom, freedom. I think a few weeks ago I talked about the simile of the raft. And this is kind of what this is pointing to also, that there's a simile of the raft where we use a raft to cross over our reactivity. And the raft is understood to be the Dharma, the raft of the Dharma, to help keep us afloat in the midst of our reactivity. And if we end up crossing over, get to the other side, not so helpful to keep carrying that raft around with us once we've crossed the river. And in fact, the teaching of that analogy points us to let the raft go, set it adrift. And at the end of that teaching, the Buddha says, and so we actually have to let go of even these beautiful mind states, even these wholesome states. How much more so we have to let go of the unwholesome ones, the reactive ones. This can be a kind of a scary feeling in a way, to feel like we have to let go of the wholesome ultimately. And yet, you know, as I pointed out when I talked about the simile of the raft, you don't want to let go of the raft too soon. You don't want to let go of the raft while you're still in the middle of the river. And so it's fine to appreciate all of these beautiful qualities, to cultivate them, to let ourselves be in that of taking up the dye of compassion and kindness. We're still being dyed here. So I particularly like this teaching, partly because it really speaks, I think it really speaks to us as lay people, as people who are not monastics, but who are living our lives in the world. You know, that the teaching here, I think, is very accessible for what's happening in our lives. It starts with simply, you know, start to get to know what your mind is doing in relationship with the world. And then also the exploration of the divine abidings. Those are also relational qualities of mind. And so we shift, we learn what it might mean to shift our relationship from being one of reactivity to one of caring and love. And this is a beautiful aspiration for our lives. So there's a couple of minutes if there's any comments or questions or thoughts anyone like to share. Yeah. And
thank you. I was so comfortable. I didn't really want to get up. I appreciate what you said, and I actually have had a few experiences. Like, I feel like I'm so stained. But, you know, I have had a few experiences, and I do see, like, over the 3 or so years that I've been doing that I am less reactive. But there are some things. You didn't mention fear, I don't think, on your list.
I don't think fear is in there, but, yeah. But it definitely is one I've worked with as a stain of the mind.
It's hard to work with that one, and even, you know, at the end when you were talking about, I forgot, you were saying something about how to work with it, but I just feel like, no, it's not okay.
that's
tangled, but
it's definitely in there, that sense of, no, it's not okay that I'm not safe, you know, and yet, you know, what is the reality is that we're very vulnerable as human beings. And so, you know, it's paradoxical, but we can begin to open to that. I think partly what it is, I've seen, at least in exploring fear, one of the things that I saw one night as I was really opening to a very powerful fear, was that, you know, I was feeling the fear and feeling the kind of sense that, you know, no, this isn't okay, while I was in the fear. The story of fear is this is not, you know, that this is not okay, this has to be fixed or changed. And you know, there are ways in which that can motivate us to do something. And yet also, if we didn't have that fear and we understood the this being is in danger, you know, this human being is in danger, without having that, the mind that's just whirling and spinning, there's ways that this being would move to take care of itself. So, you know, it's the fear has a belief that it needs itself in order for us to take care of ourselves. But when we touch into a new exploration, you know, when I was exploring that very powerful fear that night, I kind of as a ballast for my mind, I just started doing some metta. May I be safe? It's like, yeah, that's what I want. I want to be safe. And very quickly, I touched into a very deep pool of wishing for well-being. While that fear was so strong, the pool for well-being was equally strong. And when I was in that pool, the fear had no footing. There was no place for that fear to land. And so, you know, that's where I really saw, in a way, that the depth of the fear was connected to a depth of a wish for well-being. And it was quite startling how, you know, the mind would kind of shift between the two. You know, I would be in that pool of that wish, and the heart would be completely at ease, knowing that it was still in danger, you know, knowing that there was potentially danger there, and yet not having all of that kind of machinations of the mind kind of reacting. And then it would flip back into the reactivity. And it would be such a different experience. And I could begin to see, oh, this actually, there can be a different place from which to meet that experience. And it's not something that we can trust from the outset, because it's like the trust will begin to develop as we touch into that pool of the wish for safety and the kind of pool of metta and love and compassion that different perspective will begin to show itself. But it's something we almost have to stumble into through the willingness to keep going, and maybe through through hearing what other people have said about it. Sometimes that can inspire us to keep going too. So it's this is not an easy path. We are put face to face with our fears and our reactions, and yet that's, you know, that willingness to sit in there in that washing machine of that, you know, that is a form of love.
It's not an easy path anyways. If I chose another one,
it wasn't not an easy path. Yeah, it's not an easy path to be ruled by fear either.
Yeah. I will say, though, one thing I learned only recently that I probably should have known is, you know, human beings are very social. So sometimes the fear is the fear of separation or the fear of rejection is like a normal biological thing, which I didn't completely understand. So there's, you know, fear of physical danger, but fear of like social danger too, I think is a big thing.
It is. And actually, from what I understand, they are felt in the same part of the brain. Yeah. And it's time to stop. So thank you for your attention.